herzlich willkommen bei Multilingual Stories. Mein Name ist Dr. Bettina Gruber und ich bin die Linguistin. Ich unterstütze voller Begeisterung mehrsprachige Familien mit Herz und Verstand auf ihrem individuellen Weg, damit ihre Kinder alle Familiensprachen erfolgreich und mit Leichtigkeit lernen können. In meinem Podcast bekommst du sehr persönliche Geschichten von Mehrsprachigkeit aus der ganzen Welt zu hören. Lehn dich zurück und lass dich inspirieren. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Multilingual Stories. Today's episode is going to be in English again because I have a very special guest, Dr. Shireen Charan, who recently got her PhD in psychology at the University of Edinburgh doing research on bilingualism and autism. And I recently heard about that research and found it super fascinating and immediately asked her to be on the podcast to tell you the story that she found out and her own story, of course. Hi, Shireen.
Hello. Hi, Bettina. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Please introduce yourself. Tell us, who are you? Where are you from? How did you grow up?
Okay. So my name is Shireen, and I actually was born and raised in Abu Dhabi. My family is originally from Egypt. And so I lived here like full time pretty much until the age of 21. So living in the UAE gave me, I would say, a competitive advantage as far as languages are concerned, because we kind of have two official languages here, both English and Arabic. Mm-hmm. And obviously my family's Arabic speaking, but then, you know, once you start going even to mainstream school, from kindergarten all the way up, you know, the English is definitely a core part of your curriculum. And so we take the subjects in that language, but we also take some subjects in the Arabic as well. So we kind of grew up bilingual. And maybe sometime in high school, you're also given, you know, the option of going for like a third language. So you get to choose like French, Spanish, maybe some couple of other languages as well. So I took a bit of French when I was in school as well. But, you know, I wouldn't dare say anything in French right now, now that I'm the older and have lost most of that language. But yeah, it's just a very diverse, multicultural society. So about maybe 10% of the entire population is actually from the UAE, like actual local. And then about 90% is just from all over the world. So that's the expats just from everywhere. And so, yeah, it's just all too common for us just to be always exposed to like different languages, different cultures, and to grow up in that sense. So we actually, you know, always felt like growing up, we were global citizens. And just about when I was done with my university here, I moved on to do my master's in the UK. And, you know, that's, again, just more exposure to even like more languages, even within an academic kind of like setting. So, yeah, that's where I grew up and where my relationship with languages sort of began. So from birth. And as far as the topic is concerned with bilingualism and the autism, so my younger brother is autistic, and we grew up also with a family center that specialized in providing support for autistic children and their families. And so that was always a core part of like even my journey, just the personal journey, not even my academic journey. And when I was in college here, I took a course called The Psychology of Bilingualism. Mm-hmm. And that course was just talking about, you know, just different, how does bilingualism impact your cognition, like generally speaking. And so I just kind of like pieced it together. I was wondering what bilingualism, what kind of impact it would have on your cognition, particularly if you were autistic, for example, because, you know, the research has and continues to be typically focused on typically developing children. Mm-hmm. And so I would say this is a very new wave of research. And that's when I found out that this interface had received very little attention in the scientific community. And that's mm-hmm. why I wanted to pursue it moving forward.
That's absolutely fascinating, because that was very early on in your career that yes. you threw happening into a course, basically. I mean, that yes. was not in your curriculum, probably. You yes. just, you know, you picked that course because it sounded fascinating.
Yes.
And then
yes.
like years later, you actually get the opportunity to do a PhD exactly yes. on that topic. That's amazing.
Yes. Just come together really logically, really yeah. beautifully. Yes.
Yeah, in hindsight, basically. Yeah, that's amazing. Yes. So how was the experience for, so how much do you know, what can you share about the experience of your brother growing up in the Emirates and with the two languages, at least for him as well, I guess. So what could you observe him growing up with the two languages?
Well, and I would say this is one of the core motivations for research at the interface. He firsthand experienced these, you know, widespread notions that exist until now, that autistic children might not be able to handle a second language, and that it might be too confusing, and there's already a bit of language delay in the first language, so why would you introduce a second one? So coming from that, you know, standpoint, my parents made a decision to focus on delivering the monolingual programs with him, which was quite common.
Arabic, like, in your case, probably.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So they focused on one language, just like, again, thousands and maybe even millions of parents there, because they themselves had this notion, but also they were given that advice by speech therapists, practitioners, that let's just stick with one language, mm-hmm. and that would be the best course for him in the meantime. So he was verbal. He was also included in the mainstream schools. Mm-hmm. I think he could have, you know, definitely been exposed to a second language and had some positive outcomes there as well, like even from a linguistic perspective, in verbal domains, just with communication and everything. But yes, so like many children today and back then, he wasn't really given that option because, you know, they really did think that this was best at the time. Mm-hmm. So yes, while he was exposed to second language all the time, it was just passive exposure. It's not active engagement with a second language, and therefore, you know, there were no the outcomes there as far as, like, at least verbal and maybe even nonverbal domains as well. Mm-hmm. So that was his experience. Yes.
Okay. So what's your view on that now that you've completed your research on this topic?
Well, so my view is based on evidence-based findings and the collective literature that we have to date. You know, it's just a handful of studies, but it's been done across the context, different populations, and also samples that weren't necessarily from the West. So we also have some research here from the Middle East. And it all converges to the same conclusion with two key findings. So we either found an advantage for bilingual autistic children in specific areas like their thinking skills. So these are basically skills like your working memory, your sustained attention, your inhibition skills, and your flexible switching skills.
Hold on, yes. This is going a little faster.
Go ahead.
Yes. Okay, so... Wait, you found advantages for autistic children that are growing up bilingually compared to autistic
children
that are growing up monolingually?
Yes, exactly. So there were some advantages that we picked up on using some types of measures. So we used a mix of measures. There were, like, direct measures of thinking skills. So there was, like, computerized tests. So, like, the children would sit down and play games on the computer, and these games would pick up on your abilities on things like your working memory, your attention, your inhibition, and your cognitive flexibility. So this is one type of measure.
So working memory, that's the memory that we use all the time. That's basically the thing that we have at the forefront of our mind, basically, that help us remember short-term things.
Exactly.
That's working memory.
Exactly. Yes.
A little bit more about the other measures. Like, you have inhibition. What does that mean? How does that relate to, why did inhibition even come up with respect to multilingualism and autism?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, to answer this, we can take a step back into the theory and talk about theories that chart the relationship between bilingualism and thinking skills. So why would speaking a second language even enhance, like, you know, your cognition in theory? What is that link? And so obviously there are really good theories that are founded in neurobiology, but in a general sense, like, the general hypothesis is when you know two languages, you have two active languages in your mind, And when you frequently switch between them, you exercise certain thinking skills in your brain. So, for example, I know two languages very fluently, and I'm only choosing to speak one with you because I know that's the language that you know. And in order to do this, I have to resist interference from my other language, which is also active in my brain. So that's an interference skill of inhibition. And I also use my sustained attention because I have to keep stay focused with you and speak in English. At the same time, I'm also using my working memory because I know I hold words from both languages in my head. And the fourth one is flexible switching. So I have to, you know, in the right context, I have to be prepared to switch back and forth between my two languages if say, I'm speaking with another bilingual speaker of my two languages. So in theory, that's why we would expect, you know, these domains to be exercise with frequent use and switching between two languages. And so basically what that was the first key finding is that there were some advantages in some domains. For example, there was a study that found an advantage for flexible switching, this switching back and forth between two tasks or two languages, obviously in theory, using a direct measure, like a computerized measure of the flexible switching. I found also some advantages using a parent report of thinking skills. So I've also utilized teacher and parent reports. The reason for that is if we just measure, you know, your thinking skills using one measure, say a direct assessment using a computer, well, I'm just assessing your thinking skills then at one point in time. So that's your thinking skills in 20 minutes. That's not how you are in general, right? So in order to take, just to make it more ecologically valid, I wanted to capture your thinking skills, over a wider time, span and in real life context. So things that you would encounter on a day-to-day basis. And so with parent reports of executive, the function, so that's the scientific term for thinking skills, I found widespread advantages across all these domains. And so, you know, if I basically synthesize my research with the other research that's done at the interface, we would end up with two key findings. As I mentioned, the first one is some advantages for autistic bilinguals compared to their monolingual peers. So bilingual autistic children outperform them in these thinking domains, in some domains, or an evidence of no disadvantage. So while bilingual autistic children didn't necessarily do better than their peers, they also weren't worse off. So they performed equivalently. The most consistent finding across the literature is the second finding, which is an evidence of no disadvantage. So that is a consistent finding that comes across quite robustly. And it shows that there's no negative impact of bilingualism on the children. And while these studies have focused on a particular, you know, sample of autistic children, so they were more cognitively abled, they were in this sense, as far as the research is the concern, so they were more verbal, they went to mainstream schools, the majority of them, and in terms of age 5 to 12. There is also preliminary the evidence to suggest that even children with lower nonverbal IQ, lower than the average, also produced the same finding of no disadvantage.
Okay. So the interesting part that's missing for me from that discussion now is the following. So people are worried about disadvantages. And obviously what we are testing scientifically are specific mm-hmm. measures that we can look at. But what's completely neglected in that context is the relevance of the languages for the children, which go way beyond, you know, whatever cognitive skills they may yes. have or may not yes. have. So yes. If the child grows up in a bilingual family, that yes. means that both languages are necessary in order to be able to relate to the family members, to interact. Language, as I do not get tired to repeat, is so much more than just a means of communication. Language yes. is part of our culture. Language is part of our identity.
Identity, yes.
And
yes.
not just typically developing children, but yes. that goes for autistic children as well. So, yes. you know, saying they don't have a disadvantage simply means they don't have a cognitive disadvantage. But in fact, they have a huge disadvantage. I misspoke. Yes. They don't have a cognitive disadvantage, but in fact, they have a huge advantage getting all the languages that are relevant in the family.
Exactly. I mean, that's a really key point. This is the main driver behind the research that is focused on this topic, is because the worldwide advice that families are getting is detrimental to the children's identities and social communication within and that outside the home, just boundless opportunities, if it's not based on the evidence. So, just telling a family that, I don't think you should be giving that second language because, you know, it's probably going to delay them further. So the evidence says there is no further language learning delay. So that's in a verbal sense. In a nonverbal sense, there is no delay to their cognitive skills. In fact, there could be some advantages in some domains using some measures. Mm-hmm. So language, as you mentioned, yes, it is key to forming ethnic identities and all sorts of communication and also just, you know, opportunities beyond. And I was telling the audience the other day through Katetsu's the platform, Raising the Multilinguals Live, that imagine if you were denied the option of being bilingual and knowing that, you know, we know that the bilingual population worldwide is increasing. And we know also that the rate of diagnosing a person with the autism is also on the rise. So these two things are on the rise. And what we are being faced with is concerns from parents, from the practitioners, from the policymakers about raising an autistic child bilingually. And so we should factor into the concerns that, again, you know, being denied the option of being bilingual means you will get to be, you know, you will be cut off from all these opportunities that we are talking about, which ultimately are detrimental. And so based on the evidence, parents are actually encouraged to use the language that they are comfortable with their children. And they need to factor in a few things. So number one, the evidence that we have, which is very reassuring and encouraging, but also children's preferences and abilities, as well as the family dynamics and family preferences. So combined, this is the recipe that we need to make informed language-based decisions for autistic children, just how we would do for typically developing children or the other groups.
Yes. Yeah. No family is like another. Like, yes, they're all individual. They have different resources. They have different preferences. They, yes, have different options. They have different amount of times that they, yes, spend with their children, and all that needs to be taken into account. And I find it extremely reassuring to know, you know, that even if there is an autistic child in the family, you know, yes, you apply exactly the same measures that I apply, yes, every single time that I work with a family and try to figure out what is the best strategy for that family.
Yeah. And, you know, when you speak of like strategies and the information that we know at this, the evidence-based and beyond, I think it's also important to clear some misconceptions, because possibly one of the reasons why the notion that autistic people may not be able to take on a new language is the misconception that they generally have language delays. Mm-hmm. So this is something that parents often report in the research, but the thing that we need to know is about 25 to 35% of autistic individuals have like minimal verbal output, whereas the majority are, you know, it is a very wide spectrum. And so the majority actually have intact language skills, if not even enhanced. So, so people should just kind of like be familiar with these numbers, because language delay is not a staple of the autism. It exists for some individuals across the spectrum. And we have the evidence to suggest that even those that weren't, you know, like linguistically or cognitively the average, they also were not disadvantaged by exposure to a second language or exposure to a bilingual environment. And so I completely understand if that's where parents are coming from, mm-hmm, then the common sense would follow that, wait, maybe we shouldn't do a second language. But this is where I feel it's our responsibility here as like researchers and scientists to come in and, you know, communicate this. These are the statistics in terms of language delay and also the findings that we found with bilingualism and cognition and also the language learning.
That's such important work that you did and are doing. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing. So I have a question now about, you said earlier that the number of autistic people is increasing.
The prevalence. So the prevalence is the pretty much the same to everywhere, but the rates of diagnosis are on the rise.
That was going to be my question. Do you think it's okay? So it's the diagnosis. So people got better at diagnosing and recognizing it.
Yes.
Right. So, and the other thing that I would like you to elaborate on a little bit more is, you already said autism is a spectrum. It's something that I think people, you know, are widely familiar with. But could you say a little bit more? You talked about this the other day as well, about like the terminology that you use, you know, is it a condition? Is it?
Yes, excellent. No, that's really a great question. I'm happy to receive that every time, because a lot of people will still associate the autism as a disease, something to be cured. In essence, when we say that autism is a spectrum, it means that individuals vary wildly across, you know, social and cognitive domains. So their abilities just range really widely, from the intact performance to impaired to even enhanced. So in a biological sense, so if we're speaking about neurobiology here, so the autism has been the evidence to be a brain difference. So autistic people are neurologically wired differently. And we all fall under that umbrella term, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with, neurodiversity. And so that's not just people with conditions like autism or the ADHD, but it's basically you, me, and everybody else. So when the research was done on like a neurological level, biological level, genetic level, cognitive level, behavioral level, we see evidence of difference, not dysfunction. And so that's why, you know, it wouldn't be correct to use terms like the autism spectrum disorder, for example, because disorder, dysfunction is something that we would need the evidence for. What we see are differences across these domains. And so I use either the autism or autism spectrum conditions. So it's an evidence of difference, yes. Disability, yes, but not dysfunction, not disorder, not disease. Yes, so but I think I'd also, I think it would be appropriate to add a note here about the autism. So a large majority of people on the spectrum could present with comorbid conditions. And so basically could be autism plus something else like ADHD or autism plus epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So that's a large number of autistic people, but it's important to separate the two. So the epilepsy is not the autism, ADHD is not the autism. So I think that's quite key. And also just realizing the challenges that are ahead or that are, you know, currently the presenting. If you do have comorbid conditions, you wouldn't want to attribute something to the autism, for example, if there was also something else the presenting. So I think that's just something key that is characteristic about the autism. It's a spectrum of widely ranging abilities across various social and cognitive domains. It's, you know, there is scientific evidence that suggests that it is a brain difference, and that there are comorbidities sometimes associated with the autism, but that they are not the autism itself.
Thank you. So, would you like to share one of the tests, the computerized tests that you actually did with the children? So the children that you tested, were they also between 5 and 12 years old?
Yeah, I mean, so yes, that was my age sample. Yes, they were minimum 5, maximum 12. And anything above that I considered, well, adolescence, not child, you know, in the research sense. So yes, so the computerized measures, obviously they, you know, varied across different domains. But if I were to give you an example from one domain, which is flexible switching. Mm-hmm. So I use the dimensional change card sort task. So it's called DCCS. So it's, you know, it's used worldwide in research, both with typically developing children, but also the children with conditions. And so basically that is a computerized measure, maybe about 20, 25 minutes or so. And so basically children are, you know, they're assessed on their ability to, switch between rules. So in the beginning, children are asked to sort pictures by a specific rule. So say, sort these pictures by color. And then we move on to a new rule where they need to sort the pictures by shape. And, you know, those that exhibit, you know, a particularly well-developed ability to switch, you know, between the back and forth between the tasks based on the new rule, would, you know, show more developed flexible switching, skills within that task. Basically, so what we found with that particular task is that there was no evidence that bilingual autistic children were impaired on that task compared to their monolingual peers. And using that task, actually, another researcher found an advantage for bilingual autistic children compared to their monolingual peers. So that's why I emphasize that it really has just been either an the evidence of an advantage or no disadvantage.
And that task has also been used on typically developing bilingual children.
It's very popular.
And it's been shown that bilingual children may have an advantage in the task switching.
Yes. And it is a test that shows, like, you know, it's relatively suitable to use with autistic children. And because, you know, it has showed like sensitivity between typically developing children versus the autistic children. So as a group, you know, if it's a task that can pick up on differences between typically developing children versus non-typically developing, it was suitable. Something really cool to note here based on the findings is that as a group, autistic children, if you take them as an average, they had a lower performance compared to their typically developing peers. But when you analyze the data on an individual level, so there are two types of analysis, either on a group level or an individual level. When you look at the data on an individual level, you see that the majority of autistic children actually performed equivalently to their typically developing peers. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really key insight, and it, you know, it lends support to the theory that autism is a spectrum with individuals varying widely across their, you know, abilities and skills. And, you know, a key defining characteristic of the autism is that it is a heterogeneous condition. And so that was really evident from the analysis that was done on an individual level. So I thought that was just really interesting, because most analyses will focus on groups, group versus group. And when you do that with a condition that is as heterogeneous as the autism, you lose really key insights that you wouldn't have been able to get unless you had looked at the data that way also as well.
Wow, I'm just imagining all the work that you were doing. That's unbelievable. Wow. How many children did you test?
Well, the total sample size was about 93 participants. And so a little over half were typically developing and the rest were autistic. Mm-hmm. And for that, to be honest, I mean, these are, especially with the autistic sample, these are numbers that the centers and schools here are to be applauded for, because I had the support of like more than 20 organizations across 3 cities for 1 year. And so it is a short period of time to really, you know, to maximize that sample size. But thanks to them, we were able to get, you know, reasonable numbers to be able to do this research. So we definitely need extensions and replications with bigger samples, hopefully through collaborations, in order to be able to generalize the findings to the wider autistic community.
But still, the results are so encouraging.
Yes. Yeah. And there's consensus. That's important to highlight, that all the research done on this topic converges to these like two findings. So there hasn't been any evidence of, you know, a widespread disadvantage and I think it's really encouraging to also note that, again, we have samples of children that are cognitively abled with like an average IQ, but also children with lower than that. And the finding still seems to persist, but we hope for more extensions in the future, more longitudinal kind of like data.
So maybe we go back a little bit to your family and your brother.
Yes.
So how much does your brother know about your research? Did you take him with you on the journey?
No, he doesn't know anything about the research. And this also goes back to the point about with the autism being a spectrum. So I think in the cognitive sense, he wouldn't be able to grasp the ideas that we're talking about. But then again, in other cognitive domains, he will just, you know, exceed us all. Mm-hmm. He was with me in like the figurative sense, because he was definitely like, you know, a key driver, not just because of the link with the autism, but because he himself was at some point one of those children that were denied a second language due to the belief that, you know, this could overtax them or confuse them. So we are that family. We were that family at some point in time. And I'm just really glad to be part of, you know, just make a small contribution to the evidence at this base. To hopefully, you know, use these findings along with the colleagues to impact practice, education, and policy. Because at the moment, the problems that we have, so much policy worldwide advising against bilingualism, it's not the evidence-based, and it has detrimental the outcomes to the domains that we had talked about, identities and communication and beyond. Mm-hmm. So, so definitely a very personal twist there as far as the topic is concerned. But yes, I'm feeling really grateful to hopefully change the outcome for other families that need to make informed decisions.
So let's do something spontaneous. The whole interview is spontaneous anyway. Let's do something else spontaneous. Yes. Let's use the podcast for a call to action. So you're mm-hmm. looking to network with people who work in centers, in schools.
Yes.
People who are involved with the autistic community.
Yes.
Right. So if somebody is listening right now and they are working with autistic people, mm-hmm. what should they do? Contact you, get in touch.
Yes, I think so. I'll mention something here quite briefly, because at the moment my colleagues and I are putting together a very exciting policy brief, which will completely touch on changes that we need to see based on the evidence. So something more detailed will be out soon, and I'll be very happy to share it as soon as it's ready. In the meantime, what I would like to say, so as far as like policies are concerned, they should be guided by the evidence, and the evidence suggests that families should be encouraged to use the language that they feel comfortable with their children. Mm-hmm. And so it shouldn't be part of the policy to deny that second language from therapeutic the programs, from their mm-hmm. academic life, their social life. So, you know, they should receive that same level of integration as they're typically developing peers. As far as policy also is concerned, we're also hoping to, help organizations move forward with bilingual intervention, the program. So that's really important. As far as the therapists are concerned or the practitioners, they pretty much deliver, you know, the programs in one language based on the law and the policy. So that's also something that we hope to change, either a bilingual intervention, the program, bilingual also assessments for the child. That's really important, especially when you're looking at things like vocabulary. So bilingual children in general, typically developing or not, will have smaller vocabularies if in each language. So if you just measure one language and don't factor into the equation the vocabulary of the other language, they come out as impaired, or they come out as like less. So that's also important for the assessment to be bilingual, to focus on both the languages, the intervention to focus on both languages, the social support that they receive from the school, from social environments, for that to also have a bilingual exposure should the family deem that, you know, necessary. And just to factor into the equation, like the family dynamics and the preferences, the child's abilities also, and the preferences as well, combined, that is the recipe for, you know, making informed-based decisions that have to do with language.
So who are you looking for right now to spread this message?
Well, it's a mix of people, really. So it's ultimately like policymakers, that would be great, because practitioners and families will be following, you know, kind of like the policy that was passed down to them. So definitely the policymakers, the educators, practitioners, families, because these are all stakeholders at the interface that we're talking about. And also definitely at the same time, other researchers and just the wider autistic community, really. But yes, I would say basically being able to communicate the evidence base to all of these groups.
So policymakers, educators, if you're listening, or parents, if you know a policymaker or educator,
yes,
tell them about the research. Have them get in touch with Shireen.
Yes, and we will also do our best to distribute the policy brief that we're working on to make sure it goes to the right hands and generate the impact that it needs.
Mm. Such amazing work, really. Now, moving away from the specific focus on the autistic population and to simply the bilingual multilingual population, the children, yes, and the grown-ups.
Yes.
Is there a connection that you can see or that you maybe even experience between being multilingual, being able to communicate in more languages, being able to relate to more cultures, and like the big questions of our times? Like, we have a few crises at our hands at the moment. Do you see that, or is there a contribution that you see that multilingual people can make to these issues?
Well, aside from the zoomed in potential, the benefits of, say, enhanced cognition or enhanced creativity, even, there's also some research on that front about people knowing more languages being linked to their creative capacities. In the zoomed out sense, I would say that multilingual people are better equipped to see the world from different perspectives. And this enhances their ability to communicate in today's global economy and provide global solutions. So in the zoomed out sense, it is the fact that multilinguals will bring in a plethora of perspectives and will be flexible enough to understand those different perspectives, to adapt to them, to factor them into the equations. That's what we need, you know, this understanding and absorption of like different perspectives will ultimately lead to very productive solutions for the global economy for today and beyond.
Shireen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bettina.
Thank you for your time. Thank you so much for your work and for sharing it and spreading it wide and loud. I wish you all the best and lots of success in spreading the message and in changing the system from within. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me and for offering a platform for us as researchers and scientists to communicate the evidence base. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you would like to see more of my English content, come find me on Instagram. My Instagram profile is mostly bilingual English and German, and I am linking the profile in the show notes. I look forward to seeing you over there.